This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today, I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Jeff Chang, author of Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. Jeff Chang, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Really glad to be here.
It's a really ambitious book. Why'd you decide to do it? How'd you tackle it?
Why I decided to do it? Well, you know, it was a bunch of different things kind of happening all at once. One of the things was I was very interested in sort of seeing out there a history of hip-hop culture that didn't necessarily focus only on the culture, but also put into the context of the culture. So when I started thinking about that, I realized that as a concept, this idea of a hip-hop generation, a generation coming after the baby boomer generation or the civil rights generation, the black power generation, it's referred to differently in different ways, it was in many ways very, very different. And through hip-hop, through the story of how the culture kind of came together, I could explain generational differences. And also now what I see as the generation gap getting hardened into very, very bad policy. So some of the subtext of the book is trying to talk about the politics of the last three decades of the 20th century and how that's led us to a point now where you've got really generational warfare through public policy.
How so? How would you illustrate that?
Well, you know, it began with the politics of abandonment, you know, and the left, we talk a lot about, you know, what the right wing has done over the last three decades. Where it manifested itself earliest was in the Bronx in some respects in 1968, where you had the combination of effects of white flight, half the whites had left the borough, deindustrialization, tons of jobs had left as well, and then governmental shrinkage, literally planned shrinkage, in the words of Roger Starr, who was a municipal official at that time.
Or benign, you know, neglect.
It was the local version of benign neglect. And so you see basically an abandoned borough. And so when the schools close, the kids are on the street. And when the fire stations are closed, the buildings that are set on fire in an arson-for-profit scheme are burned down to the ground.
That was an incredible part of the book, because you say, you know, 600,000 jobs were lost in the South Bronx, and then all these fires, hundreds of fires every week, and that the fires were started because the landlords were going to get the insurance money, and the insurance industry also was making money because they could issue more policies.
Right.
And it was an amazing kind of cycle of neglect.
Absolutely, and it leaves literally in a generation of kids out there to try to figure out their own way forward. And it begins with them trying to figure out how to have fun. And that's where hip-hop comes from, is just these weird street ways that kids are having fun in the Bronx during the late 60s and the early 70s. And so I wanted to talk about that. That's the politics of abandonment. And then it moves on up to the politics of containment over the last two decades, specifically beginning with things as innocuous and weird as anti-breakdancing ordinances, you know, and then moving up to curfews, anti-cruising ordinances, and pretty soon you have anti-loitering ordinances like you had in Chicago, where you had 40,000, I think, young folks arrested in the course of a few months. Most of them never charged with anything, but all of them ending up in a gang database.
And anti-graffiti laws, too.
Anti-graffiti laws, and Prop 21 is sort of the culmination of this. So in Proposition 21 in California in the year 2000, what you have is a ballot initiative that on the one hand makes graffiti a felony, which qualifies you now for three strikes, and on the other hand, reduces the age at which you can qualify for the death penalty. And so this is the culmination of what we were talking about before, this generation gap hardened into very, very horrible public policy.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Jeff Chang, author of Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. I loved a line in your book, give them an apocalypse and they will dance. You talk there, you're elaborating the comment you just made that this was a way for people to have fun amidst all the chaos. And you also make the further point that the invisibility of the South Bronx was in some way liberating. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, invisibility was kind of its own reward. You know, you have basically folks inventing, literally inventing this culture. In fact, inventing becomes a slang word for stealing graffiti can or a spray paint cans. You invent a spray paint can. And so they're literally inventing, in isolation, a whole new way of looking at the world and doing things and stuff. And, you know, the sentence that I use in the book is that this is a generation that was born into the shadow of the baby boomer generation. So they didn't ever expect to have the whole world watching. They were having fun in the parks because the police didn't necessarily go there. You know, it was like, okay, let those kids go off and do their thing, you know.
And in that way, it let expressiveness and creativity and ingenuity really take off.
Exactly. And the other thing to note that is that this comes in the wake of a really serious and intense gang era. And only after the gangs get together in 1971 and figure out how to make peace is there this creative explosion. Because now it's not necessarily about this twisted sense of collectivity, of repping your gang, of subverting your identity to this sort of, you know, weird and, you know, in many ways negative type of situation. But now it's about demonstrating your style and your individuality. And so in that sense, you know, you're literally having this way, this form of play, this hip-hop, as a way to redeem yourself, you know, as somebody who's supposed to be nothing. And later on, it's a way to redeem yourself literally in the marketplace, to take off that invisibility, to scream against, the invisibility that people want to put onto you.
In your book and in the CD that comes with the book, Chuck D says that he never thought that hip-hop could be made into an album. Mm-hmm. Why did he think that, and how did it come about?
Again, this is a street culture. It's a neighborhood type of thing. It's a block party thing. It's a community center type of thing. And at that particular time, rap music was fairly new. Rap was invented as a way to supplement what the DJs were doing in the dance. You know, the DJs had figured out from DJ Kool Herc, they had figured out that the part that the dancers like to dance to was the instrumental breakdown, the stuff where everybody drops out and the percussionists just go off. You know, that's where the dancers really get down. And out of that, you know, Herc has this memory of Jamaica, and he remembers that it's basically over the dub versions, the instrumental versions of songs, that, you know, DJs, what we call MCs here, get up and toast over the instrumental version. So he's doing that. He's shouting people out in the crowd and that kind of thing. And that's where this whole thing of rapping comes from, is sort of this extension of that particular moment in the party. And so it's, you know, kind of done in this live context. And at the time, you know, 1977, 1978, 1979, this style of throwing parties has spread outside the Bronx. It's very big in Brooklyn. It's moved out to Queens and Long Island's Black Belt. It's huge in the Lower East Side. It's very, very huge in Harlem. And this is a thing, it's like 3-hour jams. And so he can't see how you can put all of that 3 hours onto a record that can only fit 20 minutes on a side, you know? And that's where he's having a hard time imagining it. It was like that with all of the folks that were big in the scene at that particular time. Grandmaster Flash, for many years, would not sign a record contract because he couldn't imagine it either.
And so how did this first hit, Rapper's Delight, come about?
Three unknowns from New Jersey. Okay? So three unknowns from New Jersey get together, and a record label called Sugar Hill Records brings these folks together and says, you're going to rap over the song Good Times, you know, go ahead and do your thing. And these are fans of the scene. These are folks that are going to the parties, they're picking up on the lines, they're out there listening to the tapes that are being played in these gypsy cabs that you can catch, you know, in the boroughs and stuff. And their whole thing, their whole interaction with the music is completely different. In a live show, it's about shouting out the crowd, shouting out your DJ, shouting out the neighborhood that you're from. These guys are listening to it on tape, and they're hearing about stories about Superman and his pantyhose and, you know, the chicken tastes like wood. And those are the things that they really get into. And so those are the things that end up in their song. And so when it hits the public, it's got this universal appeal that you wouldn't have had had you taken a group out of the Bronx, like Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, and put them onto Wax.
Well, Jeff Chang, why don't we just stop here and play Rapper's Delight so that the listeners can remember how it all got started.
Bang, bang, the boogie to the boogie, say up, jump the boogie to the bang, bang, boogie, let's rock. You don't stop, drop the rhythm, that'll make your body rock. Well, so far you've heard my voice, but I brought two friends along. And next on the mic is my man Hank. Come on, Hank, sing that song.
Check it out, I'm the C-A-S-N, the O-V-A, and the rest is F-L-Y. You see, I go by the code of the doctor of the mix, and these reasons I'll tell you why. You see, I'm 6'1", and I'm tons of fun, and I dress to a T. You see, I got more clothes than Muhammad Ali, and I dress so viciously. I got bodyguards, I got two big guns that definitely ain't the whack. I got a Lincoln Continental and a some new Cadillac. So after school, I take a dip in the pool, which is really on the wall. I got a color TV so I can see the Knicks play basketball. Hear me talking about checkbook, credit cards, more money than a sucker could ever spend. But I wouldn't give a sucker or a punk from the rock and not a dime till I made it again. Everybody go, hotel, motel, what you gonna do today? Cause I'm gonna get a fly girl, gonna get some spank and drive off in a Death OJ. Everybody go, hotel, motel, Holiday Inn. Take a friend, a Master G, a Mouth Mellow, it's on you, so what you gonna do?
Well, it's on and on and on and on and on. The beat don't stop until the break of dawn. I said a M-A-S, a T-E-R, a G with a double E. I said I go by the unforgettable name of the man they call a Master G. Well, my name is known all over the world by all the foxy ladies and the pretty girls. I'm going down in history as the baddest rapper that ever could be. Now I'm feeling the highs and you're feeling the lows. The beat starts getting into your toe. You start popping your fingers and stomping your feet.
Now, was there resentment afterwards that these three unknown kids from New Jersey who weren't leading the hip-hop parties in the Bronx and in Harlem all of a sudden made it and no one else had made it?
I think there was, and to this day I think there still is, but I don't think it could have happened any other way. Because again, Rapper's Delight was a track that had that universal appeal. It was one of those things that a kid, you know, growing up anywhere around the world, me growing up in Honolulu, Hawaii, could listen to and understand and immediately get.
Did you hear it when you were in Hawaii?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was one of those things where, you know, it came out one day and next day everybody around school was reciting it. And it happened the same way around the world. You know, Jamaica and Brazil, they all did cover versions of Rapper's Delight, which is a really strange kind of concept that you're doing a cover version of a rap song. But, you know, that's kind of what happened immediately. In the Bronx, what happened was Grandmaster Flash in particular thought of it as, hey, here's a way that I can get more gigs. You know, he's thinking of it in terms of an advertisement for his live show. And so the paradigm shift took a while to kind of get there, you know, for folks to begin to understand that, wow, making records, putting rap music, putting hip hop culture onto records is actually a whole different way of approaching this particular culture that came up from the streets in the boroughs.
And Jeff Chang, you deal with this tension between universal appeal toward commercialism versus authenticity. And you say in a nice line somewhere in your book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, that hip-hop very quickly was being commercially refined like sugar. Why don't you talk about that interplay between whether you're going to be commercial or sell out, if you will, and whether you're going to be authentic?
Well, the first thing is to look at it in terms of what happened to the records. Okay, so we had a three-hour performance, and now it's boiled down to a 15-minute record. And over time, that becomes a three-minute record with, you know, verse, chorus, and hooks, you know. And so there you go. There's your refinement process. And I grew up in Hawaii, so refinement to me is sugar. That was kind of where that line came from. But the interesting thing about this idea, going back to making a name for yourself, okay, and this idea of sort of creating an identity for yourself being the driving force of hip-hop, because it is. It's about style. Style is really the primal engine in the evolution of hip-hop culture, and really in terms of the hip-hop generation in many ways as well. Individual style. And expressing your style again, it can redeem you as somebody who is supposed to be nobody, or it can redeem you as currency in the marketplace. And so it's really interesting now that back then it was about making a name. DJ Kool Herc, the first DJ, was out there before that as a graffiti writer, writing his name, you know, Clyde as Cool, on the walls, quite literally. And so you go from writing your name on the walls to now having individual artists being brand names, you know, making a name to brand names. So that artists like P. Diddy, entrepreneurs like Russell Simmons, you know, who's my old boss actually in some ways, and people like Jay-Z, able to be brand names, that they are now selling a lifestyle.
What was your work with Russell Simmons?
I actually worked at 360hiphop.com and was doing the political side of that with him, and participating and doing a lot of coverage around the 2000, you know, convention and the Wrap the Vote efforts during that time. And so it's continued. You know, it's a process that we're still kind of at the beginning of. In 2004, you know, I was involved in two efforts, the National Hip Hop Political Convention and the League of Pissed Off Voters, a.k.a. the League of Young Voters, a.k.a. the League of Independent Voters. And, you know, out here, right, in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee in particular, the League of Young Voters was able to mobilize enough young, you know, alienated hip-hop voters, folks who had never voted before, that they were able to help, you know, carry win the state in that respect. And so, you know, we're kind of at the beginning of this process where people are looking at hip-hop as a cultural force that now needs to be leveraged into political power. And I think that at the grassroots level, folks are really trying to divine a way to make that a principled progressive type of force, to be able to establish a moral type of vision.
And there, Jeff Chang, has been a current of political undertone, anyway, to some hip-hop music going all the way back. And Chuck D was someone who did a lot of that. And I remember reading in your book him saying people thought or acted like I was Jesse Jackson.
Right.
And this was his way both of acknowledging that there's a void of leadership, I think, in the African-American community, and also saying, you know, I can't be that person. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering how you see the politics of rap music evolving in either in the music or in what the artists are doing.
Well, there's kind of two different things that are going on. One is that there was, as you pointed out, this kind of confusion during, I think, the late 80s and the early 90s of, you know, what folks' roles were going to be. And I think that was Chuck saying that I'm an artist, I'm not an activist. Yeah, my art has political overtones, and yeah, I'm politically very committed, but treat me like an artist and not like a political leader. And that, again, as you're saying, it spoke to a void in leadership, a lack of leadership in communities of color, and the generation gap that kind of had happened there, where in many instances leadership was not passed on, or wasn't done so in a very successful kind of manner.
Also, Chuck D himself and Public Enemy were criticized for some of their politics.
Yeah,
criticized
absolutely.
For their anti-Semitism and their misogyny and homophobia. And that criticism isn't unique to them. A lot of rap artists are accused of that and are guilty of that. To what extent is that poisonous, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's I look at it as, in some ways, it's a very difficult situation, first of all. You know, what you've got is a spectrum of voices that are out there in the community. Okay, on the one hand, you might have voices that are women's voices. On the other hand, you've got very, you know, sexist voices. On the other hand, you know, you've got voices that are very progressive. You got voices that are very regressive. There's a spectrum of voices in the community. When hip-hop becomes commodified, a certain part of that spectrum is going to get amplified.
And why is that, and what part is that?
Well, look, I mean, you got a situation where hip-hop is driving now billions of dollars in goods. You've got artists that are brand names that sell everything from clothing to vodka to movies to everything else, shoes. And, you know, in that instance, that's where the money is heading towards. It's heading towards the part of the spectrum that can help global media monopolies in their quest for, you know, profits. And to get these bundles of goods sold as lifestyles, these synergies that they call them, you know. And so dealing with that in that particular type of way, you're not going to necessarily get artists that are not about, you know, selling you all of these types of things together, getting a lot of funding within that type of situation. So this whole spectrum of voices that's out there, we're only hearing a small fraction of it, a very small sliver of it, through the global media monopolies. Hip-hop as it's practiced on the ground, you know, is very similar to the way it was practiced on the ground back in the Bronx during, you know, the mid-70s. It's a local live culture. And when you look at it as a local type of thing, the politics begin to make sense, because the same kids that are going to the spoken word things and the B-girl jams and the DJ contests are the same kids that are pissed off about what's going on with the policing in their streets, or what's happening in their particular schools, where they're closing down schools or shutting down after-school programs or that type of thing. They're the same kids that are pissed off about it. So politics and hip-hop activism makes perfect sense when you look at it from that point of view. But we're seeing a small sliver of it through the global monopolies there. And I think that what's important for us to recognize is that it's part of a spectrum. I've got friends that are rappers that may have been really, really hardcore, and they've moved in a political direction. You know?
Who are some of the exciting progressive hip-hop artists?
I mean, there's a lot of
like?
Voices that are out there. I mean, that's the really interesting thing about it, is that we've probably got more people out there now doing great work that's politically conscious than there were during the height of Public Enemy's popularity. You know, so everybody from Blackalicious and the Maroons, you know, who are my homies, on out to Immortal Technique, to Boots Riley and the Coup, you know, to Zion I. There's a number of artists, you know, that are out there doing the thing. And it's very important that we get out there and support those folks, because the global media monopolies aren't going to.
And I think what they like and think is the most sellable thing is gangster rap. And gangster rap, some of it in your book seems to come out of the L.A. scene. And I wanted to just play Murder Rap, which is a song that you have on the CD that accompanied the book, because I think that is kind of the forefather of what we're seeing with 50 Cent, for instance. So let's play that cut and then talk about it for a second.
They trying to give you a murder rap, and you ain't even like that. Yo, sir, these niggas, cause they deserve to get this.
Check this out. When I sit down and write and recite, put the mic at home, make sure my beats are loud and bold and cold. 187, that is my name, making it simple and plain. Here to rearrange and change the things that I couldn't do in the past. Don't be surprised when you got a shot. Get up your ass, perpetrator. That one was just for you. I'm gonna leave the ENC for Mega without a clue. Style like a fiend on coke, but if you say the wrong thing, I wash your mouth with soap. No, it's not the answer, no, I'm not a cancer, no, I'm not a hero, zero, but a Leo in stereo. And this is not a demo, chaos and go back, keep cutting the flex, tempo back.
They live on the street and they hustle for fame. Some kill for a living, some sling cocaine, because it's now a lifestyle and a full-time job. And if you live in Compton, it's like a macabre.
Explain what was happening there in South Central and how that connects, say, with 50 Cent, what we're hearing now.
Well, you know, South Central is connected to the Bronx by the politics of abandonment. You have jobs, government, business, and whites fleeing South Central at a very, very early age, you know, early stage in Los Angeles's history. In fact, Watts and South Central are areas that are, you know, cordoned off after the war, in some respects. You've got racial covenants that are affecting the way that housing is building up in those particular areas. And then you've got the opening of huge public housing projects in Watts as well, which concentrates the poverty in a similar way to what they did in the South Bronx, what Robert Moses did in the South Bronx, opening up huge housing projects in the South Bronx and the Southeast Bronx. So the politics of abandonment definitely links the two. And then what happens is you have, international kind of Cold War politics having their effect as well. I mean, Los Angeles begins to feel the side effects of Cold War adventurism in Central America. You know, this is where the drugs are run up through. This is where the guns come from. And, you know, at the same time, you have the wholesale destruction of the Black Power movement in L.A. through COINTELPRO. And so literally out of the ashes of the Black Panther Party and their, you know, fabricated beef with the US organization comes the gangs. All of these folks that began the gangs in the late 60s and early 70s in Los Angeles were students of Bunchy Carter, you know, students of Malanga Karenga, students of the Black Power, Black Liberation Movement, who were looking at that as a way to set up their structures for gangs. And gangs proliferate, you know, because of all of this type of stuff that's going on. And by the 80s, you've got a situation in which guns and drugs and turfs and the whole thing that we saw in the Bronx, you know, in the late 60s has taken, you know, root in Los Angeles. And so rap at that time, you know, is drawing on that kind of scene. You know, it's drawing on those kinds of legacies and histories.
Unfortunately, we only have about a minute left. Jeff Chang, author of Can't Stop, Won't Stop. One contentious point in your book is the claim that hip-hop is a triumph of desegregation. You know, forget about busing here. Forget about racial reconciliation imposed from above. We're getting this from down below. My question is, you know, for white middle-class or upper-class kids to be dancing and lip-syncing along with gangster rap doesn't seem real to me. And what is that phenomenon like? Is that really a thing to salute as a triumph of desegregation?
Well, it's an interesting type of thing. If you can consume blackness or you can consume the other in a way that's as simple as getting out of your car, walking into a Best Buy, buying a CD, taking it home and putting it in, you know, to your stereo. No, that's not necessarily a triumph of desegregation. What I was making the point about was that whether we realize it or not, resegregation has occurred, and it's intense. And anybody that goes to a high school these days will notice it. And hip-hop is still the thing that brings folks together. So it's not a political thing. It's the beginning of that, and I think we're at the beginning of that with hip-hop activism. But I think it's a powerful way for folks to begin to identify across class, race, and different types of lines that are put out there.
That's going to have to be the last word. Jeff Chang, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Jeff Chang is the author of Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. Do you want to give a website where people can find out more about the book?
Please come to www.can'tstopwon'tstop.com.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.